Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Friends, welcome to the Tenders and Bagels podcast. It's me and Owen again. Final tournaments of the season. The WTA actually just finished the second tier finals, which is a little higher than a 500, a little lower than a 1000. Bia da Maia won, which is great for me as a Brazilian Canadian. But then the WTA finals are starting, and the ATP is still running on a Paris Masters, which we will avoid for today, but we will get back to it at the end of the tournament. So don't worry about it. We still got it covered in this podcast. But today, we are going to start off with the WTA Finals, which is everybody knows it, the final tournament of the season. It should just be a big party. It should just be, like, in the sense that, like, should be, like, a big end of the season celebratory huge tournament with great crowds and a great venue, and because of recent issues that the WTA has had in the past couple of years, it hasn't really been that way. Even though the field is amazing, it's probably some of the best top eight that we've had. I don't even know, like, in years, maybe. Like, I feel like every single one of these women is a huge threat to this title. They're going to go for it, and it's going to be great tennis. But as per what I've looked online just before coming over here to this podcast, the central court on the WTA Finals is only about 4,000 seats, which is ludicrous. It's a very small venue. But we'll get into this. But before, how are you doing, Owen?
Yeah, I'm doing well. And it's a shame that the organization of this tournament has been terrible this year. Like, they only figured out where it was going to be very recently, and then they only got the stadium fully built even more recently than that. And I'm not one of the people who's complaining about, like, oh, they're, like, never going to get it built in time because they did. I think it's more just the fact that they left it so late kind of shows that they didn't prioritize it as much as they should have. And, you know, like you said, it's a great field. This should be a big tournament. The quality of play is going to be very good, I think. And I don't know if everyone has a chance to win it, but I think probably, like, 4, 5, 6 players do. Like, I think the top six is incredibly strong right now. I'm excited to see how it unfolds, and hopefully the tournament itself is a lot better than the lead up to it.
Yeah, and as we speak, we already had two matches happened. I don't know when the next one starts at the time zone. I haven't really gotten used to it yet because I was still thinking much of, like, the Asia and now Europe in the ATP. So getting back to Cancun, I'm just kind of having to readjust to, like, the scheduling. But Rybakina lost to Pegula, and I think it was like a 6-4, 6-1, I want to say, but I don't really recall. 7-5 something? 7-5, 6-2, which is still pretty comprehensive scoreline for Pegula. And Sabalenka just handed a double bagel to alternate Maria Sakkari. Sakkari, who's had, like, a highs and lows season, didn't really do great in the slams, but then won her first WTA 1000 title and second title of the season in Guadalajara not too long ago. So in Mexico still. Like, so I won't say that she should have an advantage about it, but, like, she at least kind of coming back to a place where she probably has good memories, at least in terms of, like, Mexico as a whole. We know Mexico is a big country, but I guess, as you said, especially after those two matches, it kind of gives you a better sense of, like, maybe who's going to be the favorite. And it doesn't look like Sakkari is, and maybe not even Rybakina at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there are a few takeaways from these two matches. I mean, the first one is that Sabalenka is, you know, absolute destroyer.
Yeah.
that's an amazing scoreline to put on someone else at the, you know, year-end finals. And, you know, Sakari, I know she was the alternate, but still that scoreline is incredible. So I think you have to make Sabalenka the favorite. I think, you know, she won it last year. I think when she's at her best, she's got the highest level in the fields. And, you know, that scoreline just speaks to what she can do. And then I think the other match, I think for me, the headline is more kind of Rybakina losing in this way rather than Pegula winning. It's a very good win for Pegula, but I think Rybakina, she's a fantastic player, and I think she might be one of the best front runners on tour. I think that when she gets ahead, she's almost impossible to stop. But I think there have been a few results this year that suggest that she's maybe not the best fighter. You know, she went down to Hans Jabeur at Wimbledon 6-1 in the third. Here, you know, close first set, lopsided second set. And I do think she's a better player than Pegula. So I think that scoreline is not great. So that might be something I'll keep an eye on in the future. But I think Pegula is another one who can win this tournament. You know, she has her struggles in majors, but this is formatted differently. The pressure might not be quite the same. So I'll have my eye on her too.
Yeah. I think from the highlights, one of the things that I saw it's a small sample size of shots that were happening, but just Pegula just like returning really well. So it might just be a case as well, like Pegula just having a really good day at that time. And it started a little rough. Rybakina went up front, but Pegula just got back in the game and just started being more aggressive. I think that's probably one of the things that you say. Maybe Rybakina started getting too passive and just went on a spiral negatively in Rybakina's way, which it means there's not going to be any emotions shown. But I guess her game kind of shows when she's not really at her best, maybe mentally even. So yeah, we'll see how that one goes. But yeah.
Yeah, I think the stat here is that Rybakina won 56% of points on her first serve. I think she probably is the best first serve on tour. So when it's that low, I think that speaks to how well Pegula is returning and also the kind of day Rybakina was having.
Yeah, and normally Rybakina is like a low percentage of her serves in as well, right? She's normally like ranks about like 50 to 60 max. Yeah. When she has a good day, it's like 60%.
Yeah, she made 58%.
Yeah. So yeah, it's like, if she's not winning at least like 70% of her first serves, I feel like it's not really her A game that's coming. So yeah.
Yeah, I think just like, and usually she wins her first serve, winning points on it is so automatic. You know, when the Australian Open, I was at her semifinal with Azarenka, who's a fantastic returner. And oh my God, Rybakina was so dominant behind the serve. I mean, not that she didn't get broken. I think she got broken 3 times in total. But in the first set, she made about half of her first serves, and she still won it. And I remember thinking, like, she can still go up a gear. And she did, and she won the second set more easily. So it's interesting to see. I think the scoreline is almost how she usually beats her opponents. Like, yeah, maybe at first set, and then she picks up steam. So yeah, huge credit to Pegula.
Yeah, maybe some sort of like Stan Wawrinka vibes to it. Like, just like a very low starter, but when she picks up steam, just kind of goes for it.
Yeah, although it's interesting. I feel like Stan is like the diesel tank. You know, yeah. Like he. It's like, you know, just like rumbling and then slowly like picks up steam. I feel like he's like the snowball rolling down the hill where eventually it's so heavy that you just get crushed by everything. I don't know. Rybakina is interesting. I feel like, and maybe it has to do with her demeanor, but I feel like with her, it's more like she can switch on and off much more quickly. Mm. And usually on because she's ranked so high. But yeah, I do wonder if... like, I think her psychology is kind of hard to tell, like, what some of her mental weaknesses might be. Like we talked about, she might not be the best at fighting from behind. So, but then at her best, she can look, like, completely unflappable. So, yeah, I'm curious to learn more about that in the future.
Yeah. What do you think about Świątek? I don't think you've mentioned anything about her. You said Sabalenka is the favorite. Obviously, Świątek was number one for most of this year, if not just because of how dominant she was last year. But at the same time, I think what do you think are your chances? I think, like, in general, the conditions kind of favor Sabalenka more, and we kind of need to see how she's going to deal today in her match. Maybe to get just like a feel of like how week's going to go. But how much would you attribute Świątek like a chance of winning this tournament?
I think her chances are pretty good. I mean, you know, since the U.S. Open, where she went out in pretty not ideal fashion to Ostapenko, she won in China, and in the semis there, she beat Coco Gauff really comfortably. And I feel like that was key, because when Gauff beat her in Cincinnati, after Świątek had destroyed her 6 or 7 times in a row, that had the feeling of, oh, maybe now everything is changing. So I think for Świątek to sort of restore normalcy there, if that makes sense. And you know, it was just one match, like, but I think that was crucial for her confidence. Her first match is against, at the WTA finals, I think is against Vondrousova. I'm just gonna check to make sure.
Yeah, she's actually playing right now, in fact.
Yeah, that just started, actually. So I think she should win that one. And I think, you know, the other players in her group are Gauff and Jabeur, both of whom I think Świątek matches up pretty well with. I think the question is, can she beat Sabalenka or Rybakina? Because this year has kind of suggested that she can't, really. You know, I think Sabalenka beat her last year at this tournament. I think Rybakina is the worst matchup for Świątek. I think because she just takes away that first strike, and Świątek can't really take the initiative unless she plays like super aggressive, and that's not really her style. She has to like aim for the corners against Rybakina, and that doesn't really work out. So I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't think Świątek's going to win the tournament. I mean, she's still so consistent. She's easily had the best career of anyone in the fields, but I think right now she's kind of struggling with those Sabalenka and Rybakina matchups. So if she can avoid them, I think she'll win. But if she has to play one of them, I think she'll lose. What do you think?
Yeah, I tend to agree. I think especially Rybakina, and I think there is a bigger chance that, like, for example, Sabalenka will fall on her serve and get a string of double faults and could allow her in. Maybe she's a little bit more rushed. I think Sabalenka's ceiling is slightly higher than Rybakina's, but it's not always that you play your ceiling, right? So, but yeah, I feel like Rybakina is just, it would take her, I think she even is probably more comfortable even playing Świątek than Sabalenka is in general. I think she kind of just like trusts herself more, and this happens, and she tends to play better when she plays Świątek.
Yeah. I was actually just thinking that, like, Rybakina has become like so comfortable in that matchup, and it almost reminds me of like Djokovic Nadal in that 2015-16 period on a hard court, where it's like Djokovic was just like so unfazed by anything Nadal did, and Nadal had to like play out of his mind to make the slightest impact. And you know, that's much more dramatic than Rybakina Świątek, but I think it's kind of similar in that Świątek, like, Nadal is like a great, great player, but it's just like her normal game just doesn't have the effects that it's supposed to in that matchup, and the other player knows it, and therefore they can play without any pressure. I'm going to be really interested to see if Świątek can turn that around going forward. But I think I agree with you that Sabalenka, she's a better shot against Sabalenka. And I think those opening matches yesterday kind of foreshadow that Sabalenka is going to be the more likely opponent if they both get to the knockouts, because Rybakina is now far from a guarantee to get out of that group. So
Yeah, I think the good thing about, like, in terms of this format, just going a little bit on the tangent here, is that unlike the Elite Trophy, which has more players, so like there's like less room for grouping and whatnot, but you've played three matches, so like when you're in a group of three people, like, you lose your first match, you're basically guaranteed to like not make it. So in that case, even for Rybakina, she still has a pretty solid chance of making it. So if she wins both of her next two matches, which is still not guaranteed easy, but still she could still get like another win and, you know, make it count from like games and whatnot, because there's two players that make it past the next round. So if Sabalenka gets 3-0 and Rybakina still is at 1-2, there's still like a good chance. You don't really have to worry much about like the number one player as much as you have to worry about the number two. So it's something that she can probably rely on. She probably will try to win anyways, but yeah. And I would say that I think it's quite possible, as you were saying, like that Swiatek gets out as the number one in her group. So the chance that she probably would play Sabalenka is most likely in the final. So
yeah. And I think what you said about Rybakina, like tournaments in this format have also taught us that you can lose in the group stage and then come back to win the whole thing.
Yeah.
Maybe even beating the person you lost to along the way. You know, that to Federer in 2015. Lost to him in straight sets in the group stage and then came back to beat him in straight sets in the final. So that's a possibility too. What do you think of Coco Gauff's chances? Do you think, can she win this tournament?
I think it's tough to say. I mean, like, you always attribute like a level of, you know, danger to a Grand Slam champion. And who knows, maybe she matches up well against other players like Rybakina, maybe even Sabalenka, and at her best.
To win the third.
Yeah.
So
yeah, if she comes up like playing as well as that, like I don't see why not. It's just a matter of like, where is Coco Gauff now in her career? Like, did she hit a high at the US Open? And like, how does she feel? Like, is this something that she's really up a gear in her game, or that was like a really dream 2 weeks and there's going to be like some drawbacks and she's going to have to pick it up again next year? Like, it's just like a matter of like how does she feel in her career and how well she believes that she's playing, I guess, like, and how she's really playing. So I guess I will be able to tell a bit more like within like two matches in this group stage, maybe the first one when she plays Swiatek. I think it's going to be pretty key to tell us, but it's so different. Like, so the players are so different, the matchups are so different now at the WTA, that like it gets hard to tell, because every different combination makes you like wonder like what's going to be the end result, because there are so many more variables, I would say.
I was just thinking, it's such a diverse field of styles. Like, I mean, you have the power players, you have heavy topspin with Iga, you have the great defender in Gauff, you have Jabeur with a variety. Like, I was just thinking, as much as I, you know, don't really like Swiatek's chances against Sabalenka, I love Gauff's chances against Sabalenka, because she literally just last month that her defense is absolutely more than a match for Sabalenka's offense.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't like Gauff's chances against Swiatek. So, yeah, you have all these different matchups and permutations, and I think it's absolutely fascinating. And about Gauff kind of being in this place in her career, I think a come down kind of is natural after you win your first major. But at the same time, I'm not expecting it to be dramatic, because she's been building. You know, she had already made a major final. She won Cincinnati. It's not a Raducanu situation where it was so amazingly out of the blue that you're left to wonder, is this the first of like 10, is she never going to play this well again? You know, with Coco, I think it's fair to say like he's going to have many more good moments, right?
Yeah.
Whether that'll happen at this tournament, I don't know, but I think she absolutely is a contender. I think, you know, I honestly wonder if her biggest struggle might be getting out of her group, because I think she's going to lose to Iga, and I think Jabeur is a tough match as well. And, you know, Wondrosova is not a gimme either. But I think if she gets out of that and she gets Sabalenka next, like, that might almost be easier for her. So I don't know. That'll be interesting.
Yeah. Even, like, against Pegula, I feel like it's kind of tough. Like, not necessarily because I think Pegula in general is a better player, but I feel like, well, she's been here in Montreal as well, and she's been playing well, like, in general. She has, like, this aspect of a player which is, like, you kind of know what you're going to expect from her, and you know that this level is going to be like, it's rarely going to dip as low. So it's going to be like, it depends a lot on like how you're feeling that day, like, and against Pegula, I would say. So I could see like Pegula taking on Goff and offering like terrible resistance, like in terms of, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm in this matchup right now. But yeah, it could turn into a battle of attrition just because of their styles. Like it could just be long. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think they, having played doubles together, they know each other very well. So they're going to know how to get each other in trouble. And, you know, one of the only people we haven't talked about so far is Vondrousova, and she's already off a break on Swiatek. So, it really does seem like everyone has a chance. I mean, except maybe Sakkari. I don't know if Sakkari is going to win after that. And, you know, Rybakina's chances, I think, of taking a hit after that first match. But I legitimately think, like, at least half of the field, I wouldn't be surprised. Like, I think Sabalenka, Swiatek, Goff, Rybakina, Jabeur, I would not be surprised if any of them won.
Yeah.
I think Pegula, Vondrousova, and Sakkari have the worst chances. But, you know, even they could surprise me. You know, like I said, Vondrousova is ahead on Swiatek, who we just talked about for a while. So.
Yeah. I feel like in terms of universal justice, I feel like Ons could emerge as the winner and nobody would complain about it.
Well, that Wimbledon was crazy. I legitimately think after she beat, like, we were all talking about big three with Swiatek, Sabalenka, and Rybakina, and Jabeur beats two of them back to back. Like, I think that made it a big four, and I think it's a shame that she didn't get that title for her troubles. I mean, you know, Vondrousova totally deserved it, played a really solid final, but I think that Jabeur's run was just so amazing, kind of improbable, because they didn't expect her to beat, you know, Varane Sabalenka. And then the whole thing was just kind of emotionally exhausting by the end when it ended in that sort of anticlimactic way.
Yeah. But yeah, like, hopefully I think she was struggling with injuries over the last few months or not, like the end of the season. So it just depends also how she shows up. She had to quit. She had to withdraw from a tournament in Tunisia, which it must have been pretty heartbreaking for her, just so that she could be out there to play this one probably. So just hopefully that she's going to show up fully healthy with this one.
Yeah. Should we talk about Sinner a little bit?
I was about to say, Sinner and Medvedev just played like one of the best matches of the year in Vienna. Did you catch some of that? Did you watch highlights? Or
I saw the highlights, yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty good. Honestly, there's not much to say. I think that, there's a lot to say. But the thing is, in terms of like tactical like prowess, I thought it was interesting because like at the end of the third set, it looked like Medvedev was struggling physically, which is hard to normally like picture. Especially against a player against Sinner who has struggled physically in other matches that weren't as grueling as this. So major props to him for like kind of getting his body like up to speed with his game and, you know, just kind of out Medvedev, just kind of keeping the ball in play, just going in for like those big rallies on the backhand to backhand, which, by the way, I think Sinner is just far better than Medvedev's. Not that Medvedev is a bad backhand, but I think Sinner just can do more with it and just, you know, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think Medvedev probably has the edge in consistency, so I don't know if I would say better overall, but I think offensively Sinner is certainly better. And it's interesting. I was thinking about this, and I kind of wonder if Sinner is now kind of like, I feel like Sinner's ceiling is higher than Medvedev's. I don't know if that's like a controversial take because Medvedev has achieved much more. And I'm certainly not disputing that. But I think Sinner he's just so much better offensively. You know, like Medvedev defends better and he has a better serve. But Sinner, like, I was watching these rallies and it's like, the only way it's going to end is if, like, Sinner hits a winner or if Sinner hits an error. You know, it all depends on him. And, you know, like, maybe 1 out of 10 times Medvedev is going to get, like, a backhand winner down the line. But that's not... it's hard to do, you know, like, especially when you're playing someone that powerful. And I think Sinner, his movement's good. His return of serve is good. He's got good touch most of the time. And so I kind of think he's getting to a place where, like, he could be like a better player than Medvedev, you know, in the more, like, and I think I do think his ceiling is higher. I think if everything clicks for him, I don't know if it will, he could win multiple majors. But I think at the same time, I don't want to jump the gun because he has a problem with five setters in majors. And that comes back to the endurance thing he mentioned. In some cases, so that's not why he lost all of them. And he also can't beat Djokovic. So that, I think, like, you know, as impressive as this win is, it's like, I'm not really going to alter my opinion on him greatly until he, you know, changes one of those things. Like, if he beats Medvedev in a five-setter in a major, he beats Alcaraz in a five-setter in a major, like, then, yeah, like, you can crank up the hype a little bit. Or if he beats Djokovic in any match, or if he makes a major final, then it's like, okay, yeah, this is stuff from him that we have not seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So for now, I'm kind of trying to stay like centered. But what are your thoughts on him? Do you think, does this change your opinion on Sinner in any way?
I think it does, in the sense that, like, I feel like he was a lot more patient and, like, his game, like, felt a lot more mature. Like, maybe the endurance side is better. As you said, like, I feel like the five-setter is a big question, because we always come back to the majors to, like, gauge, like, the prowess of, like, a player in terms of, like, okay, it's like, this guy's a big deal. Like, this guy isn't so much. And yeah, he's done good stuff in majors, especially this year. But, yeah, it's gonna take more than a 500, I guess, like, to call it. Although winning in Toronto, I think it granted him a lot more confidence in himself, so he probably thinks higher of himself, which is good, because he has the game for it. And I agree. I think he has a lot more offensive power than Medvedev. If he can keep up like the defense that he did against Medvedev as well in that match, I think he could at least match it to some degree. I think Medvedev is still better. But if you can, like, make it harder even on those exchanges and, like, dominate when you're on the offense, I think it can only do good for itself. And I think I tweeted something along the lines of how singers sometimes, like, their voices way too much and they kind of overdo their performances. Sinner likes his ground strokes far too much at times and just kind of, like, just unleashes it. And it goes out. Like, there was a super easy put away that he put that he was supposed to be like a dry volley, and he just like hit this monstrous forehand, and if he was in, he was just going to be like, wow, did you really need to hit that hard? But he was out, and Medvedev was nowhere near. He had already stopped playing. So, like, you kind of have to, like, you know, control your agenda a little bit better. But yeah,
I think that's a great observation. That they think is what really killed him in the Wimbledon match against Djokovic, where he was 0-for-6 on break points, and most of those were like forehand on four-setters. Yeah. And it's like, you, like, I get that forehand is like a missile, but you have to hit it, you know?
Yeah.
So, and like, we've seen how dangerous he can be when he does hit it in. So yeah, I think he'll find the balance eventually with that, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah, but when it comes to Medvedev, I just think in general, because of his years on tour now, it's given people ample time to just analyze his game and the things that he's done to change it. Maybe didn't really sort that as much of an effect that he would have liked. I think Matt Willis posted on his Twitter that it's probably a problem of technique. So If the technique kind of doesn't allow him to do certain things, it's going to be rough. So he kind of is reverting to some of his old tactics, like staying like in the stands to return serve, which works for him, but not all the time, as Alcaraz proven time and time again, except for the US Open. But anyhow,
it's interesting. I've had a few conversations recently that have kind of reframed the way I think about improvement. And I think this might be obvious to everyone listening, but I didn't think of it this way. I think it's less about adding new shots and more about maximizing what you already have, you know, because I think you are what you are from a certain point, you know. I don't know, maybe late teens, early 20s, like Medvedev gets on tour, he's lanky, he defends well, really consistent, weird looking forehand, touch all over the place, big serve, right? And that's kind of who he is, right? So if it's just about make that big serve as big as possible, make that consistent backhand as consistent as possible, make that, you know, maximize that wonky forehand. But the point I'm trying to make is that his forehand is never going to be a great forehand, in the same way that Tsitsipas's backhand return is never going to be a great backhand return. Like that, it's just impossible. You know, it's about minimizing the weaknesses. It's not about turning them into strengths, because that just doesn't happen, except to like GOAT level players. Like Djokovic was atrocious at net. He's now great at net, but that isn't going to happen with these guys. And it makes me think, like Medvedev, you know, I think when you're better than Medvedev, he's not all of a sudden going to become better than you. Like, I think if you can, like, maybe he beats you a few times at the beginning, but I think once you start beating him and you find a way to do it consistently, I don't know if he is adaptable enough to change that. And I don't know if his game is adaptable enough to change that. And I think we've seen that with Djokovic, where, yeah, I know Medvedev beat him this year, but, you know, Djokovic was not really in match playing shape. And I think Djokovic now has a pretty solid grip on that rivalry with the Serb and Wally. And we've seen Medvedev can't get through that. He lost in straight sets at the US Open. And so now I wonder if Sinner lost a bunch in a row, but he's now won two straight. So I kind of start to wonder, like, maybe he's going to have control of this rivalry now. It's probably too soon to say. He's only been and they've been close. But, you know, if he has made that jump where he's now at or above that level, like, I don't necessarily know what Medvedev would do to beat him, right? Like, he's, like, in these long rallies, what would you have Medvedev do? Like, he can't, he's not going to overpower him on the forehand. And, like I said earlier, I think, like, maybe 1 out of 10 times he can get in a good backhand down the line that's going to force an error or something. But besides that, I think it's just, like, hoping the center makes an error eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, if this is his gameplay, then this is his gameplay. And I think the backhand is like where he lies, like on his biggest strength. Like if he can hit like big, you know, backhands down the line, or the interestingly backhand inside out that he sometimes like to hit, which is, I think those are good shots that he can use to, you know, change the dynamic of a point. But I think one of the biggest things that I feel like Medvedev can improve is just like going to the net and ending points. Like, he doesn't need to be great at the net, but like his technique is just scared of doing it. I feel like at some point, like, he was okay, like, I'm just like, I gotta do it, I'll do it, but like now he's just like, I'm just so much better here, I'll just go back. So it's just, I'm not even saying that, like, oh, he should like really try to serve a volley, he should really try to like do more approach shots and go for it, but like there are clear shots where he's in the advantage and he could just like do a put away volley that doesn't need to be near the lines, doesn't need to be a great volley, just kind of needs to be in. And if it is good, most likely if the player defends, is most likely going to be a lob, so he can finish it on the overhead, which is he is good at. So I just think that this is the point of contention that I have. A bit like Murray is having his issues as well with the forehand, which is like he builds the point so well, and the forehand just kind of lets him down because he just kind of pushes it down the line, but it's not really good enough to hit a winner. It's just passive enough that the other player can come back and just play a defensive slice, that's a little bit better, or like a backhand. But because you know it's going to be most often a neutral shot, he should approach the net on those. Like he has the control of the rally. He should do it. And I think that's the only thing that he can do, like to compensate for that. Because if he doesn't have the attacking shot from the baseline, he needs to finish the point early, not earlier, but in a different way. Like he doesn't have to go to the net on like crazy approach shots and play insane volleys like Djokovic does or Alcaraz is doing. I think he can pull it off. I don't think this is something that's like beyond his improvement scope. He just needs to be good enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think that I totally agree with that. Yeah. And I think that thing you said with Murray and his forehand, that falls under the improvement thing that I'm talking about as well. Like Murray, it's just not going to happen that his forehand is going to get better. You know what I mean? Like it's because it's been the same. It's been the same forehand for all this time. Like it's exactly what you said. Like he's, when he gets ahead in the point, he's going to hit these offensive shots that are kind of passive. And so it's like, he's not going to develop that Alcaraz forehand. It's about maximizing that kind of offensive, kind of passive forehand. You know? And so like, it's going to continue to be a thing for as long as he plays. And I totally agree with you about the net for Medvedev. Like these things, like you can make little improvements, you know? And so like, he's not ever going to start volleying like Djokovic or Alcaraz, but like we have seen him volley effectively, just like we've seen Murray hit his forehand effectively. It is possible. So yeah, I mean, I'd like to see that from him too. I think just to be a little more unpredictable. And I think, because with Medvedev, I mean, I kind of hate to say it because I like his game a lot, but that match against Alcaraz at the US Open, I think it almost feels a bit like a freak accident, if you know what I mean. Like, it's just like, I can't imagine him playing that well in such a bad matchup again. You know what I mean? I feel like if that match happened again the next day, it's like Alcaraz destroys him with a certain volley. Those angles that Medvedev hit were just so amazing. Like, how are you possibly supposed to reproduce those? And, you know, I'm exaggerating a little bit because Medvedev did hit a couple of those cross-court forehand return passing shots against Sinner when Sinner tried to serve and volley. Like, he can hit that shot. I just think he can't, no one can hit it that consistently except maybe Rob, because he's like the passing shot king. But yeah, I think with Medvedev, he's just kind of working with what he has. And Sinner, I think that ceiling is higher. I think Sinner is still kind of improving at a faster rate. And I don't really know where that's going to stop. So I'm excited.
Yeah, Sinner is it's a type of player who has been across for a few times. It's not for no reason. So he has good weapons. He's a good player. His technique is really solid and easy power from both wings. Has a few of the issues with the sense of like, oh, he can't really hit the slice all that well. Well, like, who cares? I mean, he doesn't need too many like knifing. Yeah, he doesn't need to knife slices all day long. Like, it's okay. Like, he has other tools to compensate and you know, hit defensive shots of an open stance, like it's a two-handed backhand, things like that. It's fine. He has more than enough in his arsenal to compensate for, like, his weaknesses. And, yeah, I'm just excited to see it. They are both going to be at the ATP Finals, which, by the way, is, like, the tournament that I'm excited for, in a sense. Like, I think it's going to be a good tournament. I just wish it was this week or last week, because it's like, oh man, like, we still have another Masters 1000 to go. Like, what's the point of this?
I mean, I don't know if you saw, but Ben Rothenberg tweeted recently, like, if hot take, but if you're going to go to Paris, you should watch Paris-Bercy instead of Roland Garros. And I look, like, nothing against Ben, but I was just thinking, like, man, when have we ever seen like good matches in Paris? There have been like two. Like, remember that we had the Djokovic Federer one in the semis 5 years ago. Amazing match. We had the Djokovic Medvedev final 2 years ago. It's pretty good. But like, everyone's wasted at this point in the year. You know, like, it's, you know, it's just not, I just don't think it's needed. But yeah, quickly, one more thing on Sinner. I think about him beating Alcaraz, he matches up better with Alcaraz than anyone else on tour. Like, he can make Alcaraz panic in a way that even Djokovic can't. Sinner has beaten Alcaraz, like, in a 6-1 set, I think a couple times, like, in a 6-2 set. He, like, it's pretty amazing, you know? Like, and Djokovic hasn't been able to do that to Alcaraz besides when Alcaraz cramped at the French Open.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that, and I think that tells you, like, how good his game is, you know? Like, Alcaraz gets suckered into trying to overpower him and it doesn't work. And it, like, when Sinner plays Alcaraz, he looks for all the worlds, like, you know, multiple-time major champion. So,
yeah.
I want those two to play again in a major soon, because I think, because the two times it happened, Sinner won comfortably and was match point away from winning in four at the U.S. Open. Who knows what would have happened if he won that one. So, I think it's a matchup I think it's good for tennis too.
Yeah.
I think it's the best developing rivalry. Like, Medvedev Tsitsipas is like still fun, still like fun origins and everything. But it's like, it's clear at this point that those two are not going to be like the level of career that we once thought was possible, you know?
Yeah.
And I think Alcaraz has already surpassed them both. And I think Sinner, it's too soon to say, but he might be on that path too. So, yeah. I think just the athletic stuff they do when they play each other is amazing. So I'd love to see them play in like the Australian Open.
Yeah, exactly. As things go, I feel like an Australian Open Alcaraz Sinner match is going to be amazing. Like, hopefully this happens, and hopefully it's like a five setter, like a ridiculous one, like they did at the U.S. Open.
The final.
Sorry?
Winner plays Djokovic in the final.
I don't even know. Like, at that point, if they're waiting for Djokovic in the final, I think I would want Alcaraz to win that match, just due to the
That's the one thing with Sinner. Yeah. Like, besides the five setters in the majors, he hasn't figured out how to play Djokovic yet. He's not like, I don't know. I thought that watching, I wonder if him watching Alcaraz beat Djokovic in that Wimbledon final would have changed anything. Because like, I think if he's, I kind of hope he thought, like, oh, that should have been me. You know, like, I maybe could have done this, which, like, I don't know if that's true, but maybe that could motivate him, because he has a lot of the same skills as Alcaraz. I don't think he's as good. You know, maybe he will be in the future, but it's, you could follow that blueprint, you know? Like, he's got a huge forehand. He's fast. He can come to net. Just can't miss your best shot on the biggest points.
Yeah. On that note, I guess, like, because you're so similar, and I've been thinking, they are so similar, and I've been thinking as well, like, about this. What do you think Alcaraz does that makes Djokovic struggle? Or as in, like, how does Alcaraz push Djokovic so much when a lot of players aren't really able to? And Sinner probably isn't able to at this moment.
So I think it's a combination of things. The thing that came to mind first was the speed. Like, he can defend, you know, like I think we've seen this pattern a few times. You know, when Djokovic hits that angled forehand cross-court, Alcaraz, like, he will like get to it, and Djokovic will have like a cross-court backhand into the open court. And I've seen two or three times between Wimbledon and their Cincinnati match, Djokovic either hits that backhand in but can't get it past Alcaraz, or he misses it. That happened in Cincinnati. Like, he had a cross-court backhand into the open court, and he just missed. And so it's like, so the speed gives him trouble, you know? Alcaraz can actually rally with him. And then I think it's that, and then the return of serve, he destroyed Djokovic's serve at Wimbledon. And then I think the combination of that forehand and the drop shot, because you can't cover both. And I think it's like, and it's interesting because Sinner has a lot of those same things, but like, he's not quite as fast. I think the forehand probably misses a little bit more. I don't know the return stats, but I think the drop shot is not quite as good. It's like a 2% difference, you know what I mean? It's like really not much. So I feel like if he can make up that difference, which is not easy, like, then he could be right there.
Yeah, I think just specifically the drop shot, I think Alcaraz does it almost like no one else on tour. He rivals with Djokovic with the timing of like when he picks to choose it, like when he's playing well. And just the forehand, like, I think the best way to describe it is like Alcaraz himself said it, like, oh, when you have a big forehand, like, you push people so far back in the court and it's going to hit a drop shot now. So he has it so often, and so often it works because he just has like this vision. I think just tennis right now, tennis IQ, just the division of Alcaraz is better. And I think the reason maybe the Sinner just beats Alcaraz is just really just, I think it's a technique issue, like in the sense, especially on the forehand side. I think Sinner's forehand is like more compact. He can like rush Alcaraz's forehand a lot more than Djokovic can do with Alcaraz, for example. And Alcaraz just breaks that pattern that Djokovic does because Djokovic's forehand is not as potent as Sinner is. Of course, Djokovic can hit a hard forehand, but it's not going to do it on a consistent basis. It's going to do it at times,
It's interesting, and I'm getting really off track now, but do you also notice, even though Alcaraz's drop shot is so good, he never really executes it that well when he plays Djokovic. It's like he's like overconscious of the defense, because it's weird. I think the time he used it the best was the first time they played, but since then, when they played at Roland Garros, I don't know if he hit more than like two good ones. Wimbledon, it started working a bit better towards the end, but most of that match was kind of the same. And then Cincinnati, I missed most of that match, so I don't really remember it being a huge thing. But it's funny, it's like against everyone else, it's natural, and against Djokovic, he kind of forces it.
Yeah, I think Djokovic also has the quality of just being just glued to the baseline. He doesn't really backtrack that much. He's not if he's defending that far back, it's probably because he's already so much in the defensive position that you're almost guaranteed to win the point. But even still, sometimes he wins it. But anyhow, so there you go. This is a Sinner. Sinner's new challenge is beating Djokovic and maybe Medvedev in a Grand Slam. And the other champion, the unlikely champion in Felix Auger-Aliassime. I'm not even afraid of saying that because, seriously, who expected Felix to win a title this year of all the years? I expected Felix to win a title all the years that he didn't, but not. And then he comes in this year and he's playing some of the worst tennis he's played in his life.
Don't you work for Tennis Canada? Are you even allowed to be saying these things?
Well, I am allowed to be saying this because I'm not there anymore. But yeah, sorry, Felix. You're still a great guy. I still love your fighting spirit. But everybody knows that it was not your season. So, but honestly, great that he was playing that well, in Basel. I think the turning point really was playing Shevchenko, and he beat him in match point down, almost cramping on his right leg, could barely push for his forehands. And he just stayed there. I feel like when he was entering that match, I was thinking to myself, well, Shevchenko is playing in the best week that he's played in his career so far. He's got a good game. He's very speedy. His shots are decent. It's not exactly the same power as Felix has, but he can find good angles, a lot of spins. Backhand is really solid. And Felix is was riding on some confidence, but not great. And he had the experience on this side. Those are the only really things that he had ahead of him. And he was match point down. I was thinking, well, this is it. I don't think he can pull it off. And then he just stayed solid. Just didn't really choke on that one. He was great. And I was like, man, this is good. What happened all the year? Where were you? But yeah, just pulled it off. And I think the craziest stat, in the final, I think he won over 90% of his first serves.
That first serve is massive, man.
Yeah.
It's so good. And I think he kind of has that Sinner thing where it's the talent is there, you know, his ceiling is incredibly high. I think a lot of the bad matches he plays are not because of his game. I think it's because of kind of the way he's choosing to play and maybe some mental issues, because I've seen him play when it clicks, and it's not only does he serve huge, he covers the courts really, really well. He's hard to hit the ball past. Go watch his Australian Open match with Medvedev or Roland Garros match with Nadal last year, if you want to know what I'm talking about. He was amazing. He's super athletic. And then you watch him at his worst, and it truly looks like a different guy. So I'm really glad to see him play well.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, just a big shout out to Felix. Kind of really well-deserved title. He had to work hard for it. And yeah, I guess this is it. Like, let's see like how that translates for the, I guess, Paris now, because there's not much of a rest of the season for him. He plays Davis Cup next, so this is always good. I think he enjoys playing it. He's gonna be fresher because he has played less tennis just out of the sheer fact of his losses. But he's, who knows, maybe winning this title, like maybe just having a good run in Paris, like reaching maybe the quarterfinals or something. He's also unseeded, but he plays, I think Tsitsipas is the first seeded player he could face. So it's
very winnable.
Exactly.
You pass on hard courts.
So yeah, I'm looking for it. I think he's got a good chance of like making a run out of it. But yeah, like hopefully he pulls off like another title for Canada in this weird Davis Cup format, but it's still the Davis Cup. But you know, hopefully he goes back to what he was at some point in history. But yeah, I guess that is it. We've covered everything. Another, I think I already said a shout out for Bia Haddad-Maia, but another shout out for her to win both the doubles and the singles titles in the Elite Trophy, which is, the doubles titles doesn't count for points, but I mean, it's good brownie points, I guess, and money. But anyhow, yeah, thanks so much, Owen, for participating. Hopefully you're resting for the tennis burnout, and yeah.
Yeah, I will watch more tennis soon, hopefully.
All right, thanks so much, everybody. You can follow us on Twitter at Tennis and Bagels. Owen is at Tennis Nation. I'm at Rollenberg Andre, I think. And Fonsh is at FonshPTK. He's not here, but he will be here soon in the episodes about the WTA Finals, which is happening this week, as we mentioned in the beginning of this podcast. So thanks so much for listening. I'll see you guys later. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.